Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, November 23rd, 2018. South Africa pledges to invest in South Sudan's oil industry.
One of them is a refinery. We will be targeting a refinery that can refine the oil. The other one is a pipeline. We will be working very closely to build a pipeline.
An unknown gunman attacked a commercial vehicle on Juba Bor Road.
There was a Land Cruiser that left Bor heading towards Juba. So at a place called Panpitia, that is where the incident occurred. The vehicle had overturned. That was after it had been shot at, because probably the driver was trying to speed.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Jonglei state officials say three children were abducted and at least five people were injured when an unidentified gunman opened fire on a vehicle traveling from Bor to Juba on Thursday. The information minister in Jonglei state says the injured are receiving treatment at Bor Civil Hospital. For VOA News, Deng Gai Deng reports from Bor.
25-year-old Ajuak Magot was shot in both legs during Thursday's attack. Speaking in Dinka, Magot says more than 10 armed men dressed in police and military uniform opened fire on the passenger vehicle in a place called Panpitia, about 23 kilometers from Bor town.
While our vehicle was moving at a high speed, some men in both police and army uniform appeared on the road behind the vehicle and started shooting at us. The driver increased the speed to try to escape from the gunmen. But other men appeared on the road in front of us and started shooting too. So there was no way out. The driver turned the vehicle to the bush and it overturned. There, the attackers came and broke window glasses and pulled out three children. After a short while, some youth herding cattle came around and the attackers ran away with the children.
Ajuak says 20 people, including six children, were on board. Atongkwol, Jonglei State Information Minister, confirmed the attack. She says the abducted children include two girls and one boy.
That there was an incident on the way towards Juba. There was a Land Cruiser that left Bor heading towards Juba. So at a place called Panpitia, that is where the incident occurred. The vehicle had overturned. That was after it had been shot at, because probably the driver was trying to speed from the shooters. So as a result of that, three children were abducted. They were taken away.
14-year-old Yarnyok was injured in her right leg. Speaking in Dinka, Nyok says she narrowly escaped being abducted. Nyok's parents allowed VOA to interview her.
The attackers shoot at the wheel of the vehicle, and they shoot me and this other person. And after a few seconds, I pound myself upside down because our vehicle overturned. This man came and broke window and took the children near me. Fortunately, cattle come, youth came running and chased the attackers.
Minister Kwal says the Jonglei state government is concerned continuing attacks along Juba Bor Road.
The governor mentioned that it's important at some point that they be escorted along that road. Before this incident, yes, it was normal that vehicles go by, you know, individually or with just one driver, one car. But because of the increased insecurity on the way, that's why there seemed to be some need for an escort.
The relatives and parents of the abducted children are calling on the government to find the attackers and rescue their children. Commuters using Juba Bor Road have witnessed several attacks. Last month, two people were killed and three others were injured when an unidentified gunman attacked a passenger vehicle traveling from Bor to Juba. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
The South Sudan government has postponed the secondary school certificate examination scheduled to start the first week of December. Education officials say they have no money for printing and distributing exam papers. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
22,000 students have registered to take the South Sudan secondary school certificate examinations. Many of the students who spoke to South Sudan in Focus expressed fury about the decision to push the exams to next year. 21-year-old George Henry registered for the examinations at Juba Day Secondary School. Henry says he has put a lot of effort into passing the test.
By the time I heard about the postponement of the examination, my mood was not all that good. I was a little bit disturbed because all my effort, all my attention, all my focus this year was been concentrating and focusing for the for my examination that will that's supposed to be on 3rd of December, and my interest also dropped down or deteriorated.
17-year-old Grace Juan says her plans for 2019 are now in a mess.
I have already planned that in January I have to do some little business to help myself, but unfortunately, as I have heard, all of us have already had that exam is postponed. I am not feeling okay, actually, because these days I was been struggling, reading heartily that on 3rd of December there is exam, so that I do my best, so that I become a better and a great doctor in future. But as now the exam has been postponed, I am not out of my mood even. I don't know how will I start. Will I again go to read, or will I read like the same way that I've before been doing?
Deng Osh is the South Sudan Education Minister.
I am afraid to inform the public that the examinations will not take place on the 3rd of December 2018 as originally announced. The new date for the start of the secondary examinations will be Monday, the 14th of January 2019, and the exams will continue up to 28th of January 2019.
Deng says his ministry needed 82 million South Sudanese pounds, an equivalent to $342,000, for printing and distributing primary and secondary school examinations materials. He says the Ministry of Finance failed to release the funds on time.
We have just received the money and we're able to transport the examinations for primary. However, the examinations for secondary will need to be printed. That will take a minimum of 1 month for them to be printed, and also a minimum of 2 weeks for the same to be distributed to the states. So we'll do our best to ensure that the exams are administered on the 14th, Monday the 14th of January, in the state of the 3rd. Monday the 3rd of December 2018.
When VOA contacted the Finance Ministry today, Deputy Finance Minister Gorge Makwach declined to comment on why the ministry delayed the funds for the examination. Last month, the government spent $3 million on a one-day party to celebrate the September peace deal. Although students are enraged by the postponement, some teachers like Samson Pitia John, who teaches Christian religious education at Juba Day Secondary School, welcome the delay.
We need to finish the syllabus and then we need to do the revision. So up to 14th of January, for sure, we will be able to finish the syllabus and we will be able to do the revision, and for sure the performance will be better. Here in South Sudan, there are so many public holidays, and this can also reduce our speed of finishing the syllabus on time.
South Sudan's school calendar runs from February to December. For the past 3 years, education authorities have not been able to hold secondary school certificate examinations within this period. Student George Henry says the finance ministry failed to release funds on time because the government does not make education a priority. For VOA News, I'm Manyang David Mayar in Juba.
South Africa and South South Africa and South Sudan have signed a cooperation agreement paving the way for Pretoria to spend $1 billion on building pipelines and refineries to boost production in South Sudan's oil fields. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Ezekiel Lolgat-Kwoth, South Sudan's petroleum minister, says the two governments are yet to negotiate details of the agreement. Gatkwath says the $1 billion investment from South Africa will help increase oil production.
One of them is a refinery. We will be targeting a refinery that can refine the oil. The other one is a pipeline. We will be working very closely to build a pipeline. Of course, in different areas, we will be cooperating in training, building capacity for our engineers.
Gatkwath says South Sudan is seeking alternative refineries and pipelines to transport oil to international markets via Kenya and Ethiopia.
We'll be working closely to make sure that the implementation of what we have signed today is realized. We will be cooperating in acquiring new blocks. I have told my brother, block B1 and B2, E1 and E2, and then A1 all the way to A6, they are available. And we will go to the next stage of negotiating an exploration production sharing agreement so that we can move quickly in acquiring new blocks.
The agreement the two countries signed comes just a day after at least 400 national and international companies concluded a three-day oil, gas, and energy conference in Juba. The conference was aimed at advertising South Sudan's oil sector to potential investors. Jeff Radebe is South Africa's energy minister, and he signed the agreement on behalf of his government. Radebe says the deal cements the close ties between the two countries. He says the investment is part of President Cyril Ramaphosa's $100 billion investment plan to boost his country's economy.
When this refinery is complete, it will have a capacity of producing 60,000 barrels of oil per day. So it's a very huge investment. And from what I understand, the whole projects, the block exploration together with the refinery, the pipelines, were looking at an investment of more than $1 billion.
The South African minister says his government has contributed toward plans for building a mineral laboratory for the oil and energy industry in South Sudan.
This will entail a petrographic microscope, a lab equipment, a fire chamber, chemicals, fluoroscope, core inspection, thin section making machine, resin impregnation machines, light and accessories, as well as training. And over and above that, we also want to open our data bank, which is located in Cape Town, of Petro SA, that has a lot of information that could be of vital importance to your department as you continue to explore oil and gas in South Sudan.
South Sudan currently relies on Sudan to process and transport its crude to the international market. Gatkwath says now that South Sudan is peaceful, his ministry is working to increase oil production from 135,000 barrels to 350,000 barrels a day. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Still on matters to do with South Sudan's oil, considerable percentage of the revenue from South Sudan's oil is earmarked for development projects across the country. Our reporter Winnie Chirino took to the streets of Juba town to find out how South Sudanese are benefiting from the oil revenue.
I'm not benefited from anything because I'm not seeing any tangible change here in South Sudan. People talk of oil money, but we don't know where this oil money is. So we have to see something tangible by physically in terms of buildings.
Benefited it through my parents, because both of my parents, they're working with the government, and this is the only source of income. Like government used to pay the salary, so paying their salary, that's actually helps me, helps my parents also to help me paying my school fee. That's why today I am who I am.
I haven't benefited from the oil.
Why?
Because if you can see the structure, the roads and the school, most of them are not renovated and most of them are all school.
Me only, I'm Anthony Anemaduta. I'm not benefited from the revenue of South Sudan because I'm not working.
I think up to now, there's nothing that I can see on the ground. So there's no good roads, no good schools, no good hospitals. So I can say I've not really benefited up to now.
These are voices of South Sudanese on the streets of Juba expressing their opinions on how they are benefiting from the country's oil revenue. Winnie Chirino collected that audio from Juba. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at polygamy in Africa and its side effects. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
which country would you most like to live in and why?
You know, since I was born, I've never been outside Malawi. So whichever country I can go outside Malawi, that would be very fine for me.
I would love to live in Scandinavia countries because of the way the people live there. They are being taken care of, especially in medical treatments. The standards of living there, I think, is high.
I must live in my country, South Sudan, whether it is in peace or it is in war. I'm proud to be there because I know that one day there will be tranquility and harmony among the people who are fighting today. I cannot choose another country because I know life is the same.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. In 2014, Kenya legalized a polygamous union for men with nearly unanimous support from male lawmakers. The Speaker of Kenya's Parliament insisted that the biblical David and Solomon never consulted anybody when choosing multiple partners. In Tanzania, President John Magufuli encourages polygamy, noting that there are 10 million more women than men in his country. But activists say it hurts whole generation of women who worry their husbands will take a new wife or abandon them. Hala Karib, the regional director of the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa, says at the same time, many Muslim families, like her parents in Sudan, have always rejected polygamy as a religious rite.
My parents, they got married in the early 1960s. And at that point of time, there was a very strong notion anti-polygamy. So my parents' generation, they felt that polygamy is not legitimate, and they resent it. At the moment, you know, over the past 30 years, the country is witnessing massive setbacks. And, you know, it's very painful to see younger generations actually quite accepting to polygamy and as a practice. And it's extremely prevalent, and it's endorsed and it's supported by the legal framework.
Aside from trying to elect more women in important, prominent positions of power, what can women and girls do to stop this practice and impacting their lives?
I think we really need to start talking about it. I mean, polygamy has been one of the issues that, you know, the women movement did not invest on it. As much, you know, it wasn't really being looked at, you know, and I don't know why, you know. I think, you know, maybe it was too close to home. It's very sad, but I came to know some of the women activists who struggled themselves, you know, with polygamy. So it's, to that extent, it's prevalent, you know.
Mm-hmm. Is it, like you are with me, is it okay to talk about it out in the open, or do you feel like you might be threatened?
No, absolutely. I mean, we have been, myself, my organization, and many other colleagues, we have been talking about it for a while. But my organization and a sister organization, Mufumi in Uganda, we actually submitted an appeal to the Constitutional Court. But it was very strong petition to actually to ban bologamy, and we list it, you know, all the implications.
When you say it was a strong petition, mm-hmm. do you mean that it had strong backing and that it was close to passing?
It has a strong backing from many of the civil society and activists, but it didn't go through because we should have done what we realize now. You know, we should have done our homework first. You know, we should have done a lot of work among communities that actually they don't see any wrongdoing in bologamy. We should have opened, you know, the conversation, start talking to men and women, start talking to young people, you know, and things like that. And that we did the appeal over 9 years ago, and it stayed in court for a long time, and then it was rejected. But one of the reasons that I guess we didn't do much about it, when the issue is not yet being perceived as a form of gender-based violence, or it's not being, it's always, as I said, being looked at as a, you know, as a culture, as tradition.
Religious too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, as religious. And people, they get really very afraid, you know, but we learn now, we have a very strong discourse where we could counter all the arguments. And I think we are prepared to, you know, to speak and address and challenge, you know, bologamy and its ramifications openly.
That's Hala Al-Karib, Regional Director of the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa. She was speaking to my colleague Carol Van Dam from Khartoum earlier last week. We now go to Cameroon, where authorities say they are tracking armed terrorists who this week killed a Kenyan missionary in the town of Yomojok in the restive southwest region of the Central African state. The slaying happened as many missionaries and foreign workers have been leaving the area following other attacks. And as the government of Cameroon and foreign embassies in that country have urged those workers to leave, Muki Edwin Kinzeka met some foreigners who have fled the restive region and reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Nigerians living in Cameroon's political capital, Yaoundé, sing in a special ceremony Wednesday to welcome 7 fellow citizens who fled fighting in the towns of Kumba and Kumbo in the restive English-speaking northwest and southwest regions. Among them are Okafor Stanley, his wife Okafor Immaculate Ngozi, and their one-year-old baby. Okafor Immaculate Ngozi says she fled from Kumbu in the northwest after she and her husband were kidnapped by armed men and tortured until they paid a $6,000 ransom last week.
You need to have seen these guys, the way that they are dressed, the way that they are dirty, the way that they are masked, the way that they talk. They were 7 in number. All of them were having guns. They took us to an unknown destination. I cannot tell you where we were taken. In short, I can't describe them because it was a very bitter experience.
The couple left their hometown Onitsha and settled in Kumbo 3 years ago. They abandoned everything and trekked over 40 kilometers before a car transported them to Yaoundé, where the Nigerian community took them in. They are among an unknown number of foreign nationals who have fled the English-speaking regions after attacks, arson, kidnappings and killings. Last Wednesday, Cosmas Ondari, a Kenyan missionary, was shot dead in the southwestern village of Kembong, where he worked for the Roman Catholic Church. He was the second Kenyan missionary killed in Cameroon following an April 2017 incident in which a missionary was caught in the crossfire between government troops and militants in the southwest. On October 30, American missionary Charles Truman Wesco was shot to death in the town of Bamenda. Early this month, three Catholic nuns and 13 novices were kidnapped on their way to Kumbo in the northwest region. They were released after 24 hours. Armed gangs kidnapped five foreign road construction engineers last year in the southwest for neglecting instructions to stop building roads. Two were killed in a military rescue operation. In April, authorities in Cameroon said they freed 18 people, including 12 European tourists, who were seized by separatists in the English-speaking regions. Several embassies now caution workers against traveling to the violence-hit areas. Cameroon's Territorial Administration Minister, Paul Atanganji, says although security has been increased, the country still needs the collaboration of every citizen for those who have fled to return when life returns to normal.
It is terrible. You cannot go in a church and kill. If we all decide not to harbor the terrorists, if we all take one statement that we have to denounce them, because what are they doing? They are doing everything which is evil. Even if you have a family member who is part of that, you just have a choice to tell him either you go out of this thing, which is very, very destructive, which is dangerous, or you have to meet the justice on your way.
The separatists have not claimed responsibility for the attacks on foreigners. The government says those killed are often caught in a crossfire between the militants and government forces. Unrest in Cameroon's northwest and southwest regions began in 2016 when English-speaking teachers and lawyers staged demonstrations criticizing what they called the marginalization of the Anglophone population, which accounts for about one-fifth of the country's 25 million people. The government says over 1,200 civilians, military troops, and armed separatists have been killed. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
That story by Kinzeka from Yaoundé brings us to the end of our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Gira Batal by a South Sudanese artist. We have been listening to South Sudanese artists singing the song Gira Batal, which means jealousy is not good. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.